You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, coming up on Film Week. Our critics will tell us about the comedic drama Late Night from Nisha Ganatra, who's the director. Mindy Kaling wrote the screenplay. First time she's written a feature film screenplay. She co-stars with Emma Thompson in the film Late Night, that one of many major releases this week. Film Week, our critics tell us all about it in just a few minutes. But first, attorneys for 21 young Americans who accused the U.S. government of violating their constitutional right to a safe and livable climate appear that they may get a chance to take their case to court. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had a one-hour session in which three judges asked questions about whether this is something that could be litigated on behalf of the young people. Their claim is that children have been put in harm's way as a result of federal fossil fuel policies, which have driven global warming. With us to talk about the nature of the suit, which actually goes back several years, is Los Angeles Times science reporter Julia Rosen. Julia, thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So this suit's been going on, what, 4 years or something? Take us back to the claim here.
Yeah, so it was first filed, I think, in August of 2015, and it was really seen as a long shot at that time. A lot of legal experts I've talked to did not think the case would get very far. But it was originally going to be heard in district court here in Oregon, and the judge there was fairly open to the plaintiff's claims, and so they agreed to schedule a trial. And that trial was originally going to begin in February of 2018. Then it was pushed back until October of 2018. And in the meantime, the government has repeatedly tried to have this case thrown out, kind of on legal grounds. They're not contesting that climate change is real, and they're not really contesting that a lot of their policies, you know, do promote the use of fossil fuels, but they think that this case has serious legal flaws. So right before the trial was going to start last fall, they went to the Supreme Court and they asked them to put a stay on the trial. The Supreme Court decided not to get involved, but they did indicate to the Ninth Circuit Court, which had repeatedly sort of tried to stay out of this, that they wanted them to hear the government's objections on these procedural issues.
And so at this point, where does it stand? Are just awaiting what the Ninth Circuit has to say about it?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, there was this hearing earlier this week. The judges asked a lot of questions of both sides, and they will issue a decision. It could be in a month or a few months. Hard to say what the timeline will be. But yeah, they will either sort of allow the trial to go forward, or they will say, no, we agree with the government that this, you know, has such fatal flaws that it just can't proceed on legal grounds. If they allow the trial to go forward, it's possible that the government will again go to the Supreme Court to try to get this trial stopped. They say, you know, this, it has all these problems and it would be a huge cost, time and money for us. But the Supreme Court has discretion whether they would hear that or not. So it's really up in the air whether it will go to trial or not.
How would harm be determined? So let's say one of the plaintiffs, you know, their house flooded because of a major storm. You couldn't necessarily tie that storm to climate change because there are too many variables for any individual incident to be tied to climate change, whether a fire or flood or something like that. So how does the plaintiff get past that challenge of proving that government policy actually caused an individual harm?
Right. That is the challenge for the lawyers, for the plaintiffs. Their argument goes something like this. They say that these plaintiffs have suffered all these injuries, as you mentioned, flooding, increased wildfire smoke, you know, all sorts of impacts that we know because of scientific research are exacerbated by climate change. In the case of extreme flooding, there's fairly good research now that shows that because the atmosphere is warmer, it holds more water, and that makes the average storm have more rainfall. So there is reasonable science to show that even if you can't pinpoint exactly why a specific event occurred, that climate change probably did make the rainfall more extreme. So that's one link in the chain. And then they need to say that that climate change is due substantially to the actions of the U.S. government. So historically, if you look at all greenhouse gas emissions, the U.S. is responsible for about a quarter. So that's a lot of historical emissions. You know, today it's a little bit, it's less because countries like China are emitting more. But basically, they're saying that the policies that the government has had in place and continues to have in place have made it easier to emit greenhouse gases. For instance, a lot of all the leasing of public lands for coal mining and oil and gas extraction, you know, that would be an example, or the way that the amount of subsidies that the government provides to the fossil fuel industry. So it doesn't need to be a one-to-one-to-one, but it needs to show that the government had a substantial role in causing climate change, which had a role in driving the injuries that the plaintiffs have suffered.
And there's so many moving parts in this because, you know, how much of extreme weather events are related to human causes, how much would be related to other factors, how do you factor in the economic benefits of fossil fuel consumption, which have arguably given young people a higher standard of living than they would have had. So there are all a lot of moving parts. Let's bring Philip L. Gregory, who's the lead attorney representing the plaintiffs, into this. Mr. Gregory, thanks so much. How do you pin down all of these things into showing a direct harm?
Well, Larry, the evidence is very clear that the federal government has both set up the national fossil fuel energy system and promoted the system and been an active participant in the system, all the while knowing that fossil fuels are causing harm and will especially cause harm to the youngest generation and future generations, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And so the issue then becomes, not only is Nero fiddling while Rome is burning, but Nero fueled the flames and is putting his foot to the accelerator on fossil fuels. So what we're concerned about in this case, and we need to urgently shut down, is that the federal government's own science tells us that we're in a danger zone, that we have a limited amount of time, and yet this administration is ignoring the science and wants to move full speed ahead in harming our children and future generations.
Of course, the trade-offs are significant economic hits that come from any sort of reining in fossil fuels if you were to do that abruptly. So how do you balance these other factors? Again, as I said, you know, consumption of fossil fuels actually was a driver of the U.S. economy, building standards of living, other things. Now we're paying a price for that. But how do you factor that into it? Separately, what would you do in other examples of government policies where perhaps you have fewer people that are imprisoned, crime goes up significantly, and young people end up as, you know, victims of crimes? Could you turn around, sue the government and say, well, putting fewer people in prison makes it more dangerous for young people to live? There's so much complexity in the when you talk about federal policy. I'm trying to get at how you nail this down.
Well, Larry, we're not talking about throwing a switch today and shutting down all fossil fuel emissions, like in the desegregation cases, Brown versus Board of Education and its progeny. We are asking the court, A, to move with all deliberate speed, and importantly, B, have the federal government itself come up with a plan to wean our nation off of fossil fuels. And for the court to set a time frame for that plan that is occurs based on the science. So it's the government science dictating the targets, and it's the government itself developing the plan.
We're talking with Phil Abel Gregory. He represents the plaintiffs in this case of young people who are suing the federal government over the negative consequences of global warming. The case heard before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, and they'll determine whether this case moves on or not. Also with us from Chapman University School of Law, Professor Donald Koshin. Professor, thank you for being with us. What do you think are the legal prospects of this case?
Thank you for having me. The legal prospects are dim for the case, but not because climate change isn't a serious problem. It is. There are dangers involved. The question is whether or not the courts are the appropriate venue for resolving these questions. As you mentioned, these are complex, difficult policy questions, which involve a lot of discretion, a lot of balancing, a lot of weighing. And those are tasks that are traditionally, under our constitutional system, charged to the legislative and executive branches, that is, passing laws and administering regulations, not for the courts to get involved. And in that sense, we're really asking the courts to go well beyond the limits of their authority, particularly if we were to ask them to mandate, to order that the another branch conduct a policy that the other branch may not wish to do, and to oversee and supervise that policy for you know, whether or not it's successful and effective over a long period of time. That's one of the reasons why I think the court's probably going to dismiss this on redressability grounds. That's the third problem.
So hold that thought. So it's your separation of powers issue. We'll come back to that. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about a nearly 4 years long lawsuit that's been filed on behalf of 21 young Americans who are accusing the U.S. government of violating their constitutional right to a safe and livable climate. The contention in the lawsuit is that the federal government has failed to respond to known threats of the changing climate and the role of federal policies in encouraging and exacerbating fossil fuel consumption, driving climate change. Tuesday, a one-hour session before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the justices listening to the arguments that were presented there, and then we'll see whether this case, Juliana versus U.S., gets thrown out or is going to get a full airing in district court. We have three guests talking with us about it. L.A. Times science reporter Julia Rosen. Philip L. Gregory is the lead attorney representing the young plaintiffs in the case, and Chapman University law professor Donald Koshin, who specializes in environmental and constitutional law. This, of course, at the intersection of those. If you'd like to weigh in with your thoughts about the legal prospects of this case, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Professor Koshin, you were going to add a third point that you thought was a challenge to the plaintiffs.
It is, and it's primarily about redressability. So this case isn't about climate change, the dangers of which are undoubtedly real. It's not even about whether the government should be doing more. They probably should. And so this case is really about what's the appropriate role of the courts, what's the appropriate role in our constitutional system. The standing doctrine guards for the doors of the courthouse, and it guards so the courts don't cross the line into doing what the other branches should. Standing requires three things. One is a cognizable injury, and it can't be a generalized grievance. It must be particularized. So we've hit on some of that already. It has to be traceable and allocatable, which is difficult, and we've hit on some of that already as well.
Can I interrupt just quickly? So I gave the example of one of the plaintiffs. Let's say she loses her house in a flood. So how does a court decide, okay, that flood was more intense than it would have been because the climate has warmed, versus there's enough randomness in any given storm that maybe that storm would have been as bad even with a cooler temperature?
It would be very difficult to do so, and that's why courts are not well equipped to make such policy judgments. These are attenuated harms with allocation across a number of potential contributors. It's really difficult, and that's why traceability is an element there. The redressability prong also fits in, and that is, even if they, you know, what order can the court give that even if there is a harm, would redress that harm? And we don't know for sure, like what you just said, that ordering the government would actually redress the problem here. The bigger problem with the redressability harm and why the court's likely to kick the case on that ground is that the courts don't have in their toolkit the ability to order another branch of government to make a policy decision. That's just simply not how we operate in our constitutional system. And the lack of that being an option for the courts means that no matter how great the harm is, if the courts can't craft an order that would actually, within their power, within the limits of their power, that would resolve or satisfy the plaintiffs, then the court can't go forward with the case. Issue opinions for the sake of it.
What about financial damages? If you can show that a particular federal policy caused harm to you that's somehow quantifiable financially, you're a victim of a crime, you're a victim of a weather event, you not have any sort of financial redress?
That's a closer case. But again, there you're going to have to prove that the government policy itself was a direct causal link to the harm that you're describing. And the harm itself, again, has to be particularized, not a generalized societal harm. Generalized societal harms, like you mentioned, the prison population or gun control or even immigration, these are not things which we can just walk into court and ask the court to order the elected branches to solve for us, even if we can say that as a result of the government not having the policies that we wish they had, that our harms are somehow higher. That's what we have the elected branches for. That's what we have the electoral process for. By asking the courts to intervene and essentially supervise the other branches would turn the Constitution on its head.
Philip L. Gregory, your response, particularly on this issue about the courts getting into a jurisdictional area and separation of powers to be dictating to other branches of government.
First, Larry, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay, so I think what the professor is stating is kind of a Plessy versus Ferguson argument. There's such a big system out there, like it was in segregation, that the courts can't do anything about that. But the Supreme Court in Brown versus Education and the California courts and the federal courts in the California prison system, all of these cases have addressed systemic problems that rise to constitutional harms. This case is not about damages. Not one of these youth plaintiffs is seeking a dime. All they're seeking is what's called equitable relief, a declaration that the federal government is engaged in a constitutionally harming conduct and an injunction stopping the federal government from harming children and grandchildren. That's what this case is about. So the ability of a court to issue equitable relief when there is an admitted constitutional violation, that's occurred pretty much since the judiciary started in this country. So that's nothing new for the courts to address. They've done it for centuries, and it's up to the court to decide whether or not she can issue an order based on the evidence.
So, Professor Koshin, what do you see as different from the historic framework that Mr. Gregory just laid out?
So first is there is an identifiable constitutional right. There is not a recognized constitutional right to be free of climate change impacts here, or to be free of all harm in society. That's a big leap to say that rises to the level of constitutional harm, especially if it is harm being caused by private actors as well. But on the redressability issue, in each of those cases, those in and of the desegregation cases, the prison population cases, the busing cases, those were first off to enforce a recognized clear right that was embedded in the Constitution. But secondly, those were sort of on and off switch ideas, right? You either discriminate or don't discriminate. They did not involve complex issues of managing the environment and figuring out what is best. We have to ask ourselves, the order in, say, Brown versus Board of Education is, did you let the kids in, right? Here, how does the court judge whether or not the government has actually done enough to pull back their policies or to implement new policies to solve the plaintiff's harm. There's really no metric by which the courts can judge. In prison overcrowding, it's are you overcrowded or are you not overcrowded? In the black and white issues of segregation, it's did you stop segregating or did you not? Those are very easy to judge. Whether or not you've done enough for climate change would entangle the courts in constant policymaking and oversight and second-guessing of the elected branches on very complex issues that involve a lot of balancing and that address something which is just it is something which we hope the elected branches will resolve, but there's a lot of harms that exist out in the world that we don't ask the courts to alleviate.
Professor Koshin, thanks very much, Donald Koshin, at Chapman University, law professor at the School of the City of Orange. Our thanks to Philip L. Gregory. He's the lead attorney representing the 21 young plaintiffs in this case, suing the federal government over harms that they're looking at suffering down the road because of the warming climate and associated negative weather events. Our thanks as well to Julia Rosen, Los Angeles Times science reporter, who's covering this case before the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Film Week is just a few minutes away. We'll find out what our critics think of the new X-Men film, Dark Phoenix, and The Secret Life of Pets 2, also the new comedy Late Night.